one of the smart things I think we did in the beginning was to hire a PR firm. Having all these brands on our platform would give it that authenticity. Not always easy for people to accept, but it's always better to hire someone who has better skills than you, who brings something that you don't have.
Eric, it's been a while. Thanks a lot for doing this podcast. I'm one of the biggest fans of Zwift here. I've been using Zwift forever. And I'm super excited about this because the journey that you had is one of the best I've seen in our industry. And let's go from the very beginning. I wanted to ask you some of the questions of what really brought you to start building Zwift. But first things first is like, how did you start cycling?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. And it's great to reconnect. I started cycling when I was a young teenager. It was a sport that I was not really, experienced in. I had a friend, a 14-year-old friend, who started touring on a bike. And, you know, this is before I had a driver's license. So I thought, wow, what a fascinating way, what a fantastic way to get around town and explore new places as a kid. Of course, we all know as kids how to ride a bicycle, but I didn't have one that allowed me to go, you know, far. So that was about, I guess I was around 14 years old. So I started touring just locally, bought a bike. And the funny story is my friend is much taller than me. And I insisted when I went to the bike shop to get the same exact bike, same exact size. I think it was a 56 centimeter bike, Kotobuki. I remember the name of the Japanese bike. Well, I can tell you, I'm 56 years old this year, and I ride a 49 centimeter bike. So over time, my bike has gotten smaller and smaller. Of course, this has a lot to do with just understanding, you know, sizing. But yeah, that's how I got started with cycling. It was, I got to a point where I needed a little bit more from cycling than just to tour around. And then I happened to bump into a local cycling club called the Sleepy Hollow Cycling Club in North Tarrytown. It's in New York, just outside New York City, in Westchester County. And I came across these three brothers, we call them the triplets. And they really took me under their wings. They worked at a bike shop. I worked at the bike shop with them and really learned about racing and training and about European racing. I learned about Greg LeMond. This was back in, it was probably 1981. That's how old I am. So, this is before the internet. We had to wait for the magazines to arrive, and it was like a month old, right? But that's when I really fell into a passion for cycling, racing. I traveled to the races in the northeast of the US. And then I started to do well in junior races. And I really caught the bug and had this, I was a dreamer. I thought, oh, wow, this is something I could do for a living. You know, when back then you really couldn't survive as a professional cyclist. But I had those aspirations. I had the aspirations of racing nationally and eventually internationally. I never got that far, but I took it pretty seriously for about, I want to say for 4 years. I think I pretty much gave up after 1 year as a senior. And I went to the Olympic Training Center because I got invited there to get tested and compete with the others my age. And I realized back then that wow, I am just not good enough to be a serious professional athlete. And this is exactly when my parents were really, really worried about me, about my future. And I started to think, okay, I've got to get my act together. I'm not going to be a professional cyclist. I've got to figure out how I'm going to, become a professional and sustain myself beyond just, riding my bike for a living. So yeah, that was how I got started. And, many, many years later, cycling is still really rooted in the DNA and the person I am. And it's not something that I became passionate about over, recently. This is since I was a little kid. Basically, I've been passionate about the sport, the activity, the history, the training, and it's a big part of who I am today.
And in terms of starting a business, what made you an entrepreneur?
Yeah, so this is a funny story. I started my career at JP Morgan, you know, I landed a few different jobs in finance, technology. And so I learned all my craft at JP Morgan. I got really introduced to technology there, was fascinated by that. And this is like during the big internet boom. So there were a lot of changes, and this was the right field to be in. And after 8 years at JP Morgan, they gave me a ton of training and experience. What I realized was, like, I asked myself, do I want to be my manager, right? My boss. And it was very evident to me that I didn't want to be him. I didn't want to have his responsibility. And you know, I thought my path forward was to be an independent. So this is when I was, I think, 28 years old. I thought, okay, well, I'm 28 or 30 years old. But, like, I have nothing to lose. Like, I don't have children. I don't have a mortgage. I was married, living in New York City. I thought, like, if I'm ever going to do something entrepreneurial, it's now. It's not like 10 years from now. So I had the opportunity with my partner at JP Morgan to start a business in technology. We built trading system for hedge funds, for banks and insurance companies and energy companies. So that was my first foray into being an entrepreneur, and, like, learning everything about, well, I have to write a business plan. I have to convince investors to give us money, right? And we have to build a team. Well, first, you have to have an idea of, like, what you want to build in terms of a business. So that was my training ground, my first business called Sakana Technology, which we did for over a decade in becoming an entrepreneur. And that was a great learning experience.
How much did your experience with that business help you with Swift? And one of the things I wanted to ask as well, how much did it help you in understanding how to raise funds? Because you raised significant funds for Swift from the very, very beginning.
Yes, yes. So we raised, for my last business, I think we started with a business plan and we raised about $600,000 from our friends and family. So it was our first, you know, experience in trying to convince someone to give us money to build a business that they barely understood. But what they did like was that we came from a credible background and that we told a good story. But we literally had nothing to show for it, but a, you know, a 50-page business plan. So you need to rely on friends and family who believe in you, even if the idea is still not fully understood, or even if, like, you know, I think my brother invested $100,000 in my business very early on, and he didn't understand what we were doing, but he thought, okay, this is something you do for your family once. And he kind of wrote it off. He thought, like, I'll never see that money again. And I think that probably rang true with lots of other family and family members and friends. It's also, I think, for them, because I'm investing now in other entrepreneurs. It's fun investing in, you know, early stage businesses with people that you know and trust, right? So that's how we got started. But then once we had a little bit of traction, we had something to show for, we have refined a business plan. We then went on to subsequently raise another $2.5 or $3 million. That's it. We didn't raise that much money. We did a little bit of debt, and but mostly equity. So that was our first experience. And I think on the back of taking investor money, showing execution, turning into a business that can turn a profit, that is where you get your credibility as an entrepreneur that propels you to go and start other businesses, because you've got a track record now, right? It's like any other profession. You know, if you're a professional investor and you're starting a fund, you've got to show that you can perform as an investor. So we were able to do that, and on a relatively scale, I mean, compared to Zwift. Yeah, that's how we got started. And look, that was our first business. We knew nothing. We knew absolutely nothing. But what motivated us was, like, look, it's an adventure. Let's go and try this thing. Because worst case, doesn't work, you know, we'll apologize to our friends and family, and we'll go on and work for another big company like we did before. Like, that was our, you know, fallback. But it turned out well. And look, don't get me wrong. Everyone needs luck. You need luck, and you need support from your friends and family. You cannot do this by yourself.
And then in terms of Swift, how did you start thinking about it?
Yeah. So before we exited Sakana Technology, that was my first startup. I started to think about the next thing. I, you know, I've been doing this for over a decade as an entrepreneur. I never had a boss, right? I had investors, I had, you know, board members, but never a boss. And I thought I was probably not recruitable, not hireable. Like I needed to be my own boss. I needed to start my own thing. So I thought, all right, well, I have to come up with another idea. And I started, my partner and I, we started to explore different industries. And, you know, we looked at hospitality, we looked at education, we looked at healthcare, and just tinkering to see like where are there opportunities and how could we create value that others just haven't been able to do. And what was staring right at me was something that was a problem for me personally, which is I lived in London, right? My last Sakana Technology brought me to London. I used to live in Upper West Side, Manhattan, with easy access to Central Park, which was my playground for training, competition, for social. And then I had literally a fast train, you know, express train down to Wall Street where I worked. So like I lived in this bubble where I could do all these things without compromising anything. You know, I was married, we had friends, I did everything in this, like in this world of Manhattan. And I lost that whole bubble when I moved to London. I didn't know anyone. There was no Central Park. I mean, the closest park was Richmond Park, which is 30 minutes away, which is just too far, to be honest. The weather sucked most of the time. And I was just too busy. So when I was getting out of our last business, I thought like, shit, this is something that, you know, wouldn't it be interesting for us to try to recreate what I had in Central Park or in Manhattan in a virtual setting. And if we can do that and get close to like 80% of the experience, the convenience, the social, the competition, the training, you know, if we could get 80% of that in a virtual world, because back then, you know, when we started, you know, social network existed, people were gaming. Thought like, if we could do this, I think there'd be quite a bit of demand for it. People like me, there must be millions of people like me craving for all the things that I am missing in, you know, from living in New York City. So that was really the, you know, the impetus and the inspiration for wanting to start Zwift, was like, I wanted to recreate what I used to have. I pitched this idea to my partner, Alaric, and he thought like, hey, you know, if we can start a business where we're inspiring people to be active, to be fit, to be healthy, like who wouldn't want to back a business like that? And he's not a fitness freak like I am. So that had some legs. I brought on couple of other partners or co-founders, and that's how we got started. Like we all believed in this mission of creating this virtual experience, all anchored on a social experience, a communal experience. That's how the idea of Zwift was born.
I'm wondering about the first steps after you came up with the idea, because Zwift is not the classic business that you can do the iterative approach at the beginning and say, I'm going to raise a little bit of money, see if there is validation, and proceed with that and listen to users. Zwift, from the beginning, from what I was following, it was much, much bigger. Like the vision was much, much bigger than that. And it was also, it required a lot of capital, a lot of people, a lot of content, there was a lot of parts that you needed to build. So how did you approach that?
So one of my co-founders, John Mayfield, he had already started building this video game for himself. So he built that because he had a problem, which is he was too busy working. And when he got home, it was too dark. So he wanted to have a game to keep him motivated to train indoors. And there were other indoor training products at the time in a video game setting. But what I saw in his product was the beginnings of something much more attractive, like much more sophisticated. But it was a single user experience. And what I had in mind was something, it had to feel social. Like when you go there because there are other people there, right? That's the magic of what Zwift is today. So my partner and I, we had made some money from our last venture. So we were able to write checks to fund this business from the very beginning. And that was, you know, of course that helps from an entrepreneur standpoint, that allows us to build something before actually going out raising money. If we had, in this case, you know, only a concept, no product, and go and raise money, I mean, we would have lost so much equity, even if people were excited about the idea. Funding it ourselves in the beginning was a huge way to get this thing off the ground, build a small team. I think we had a team of maybe 8 people or less than 10 people that took us to the summit. So we started the business in January, got the 4 partners together. My partner and I funded the original seed capital. And then in the summer, so like 6 or 7 months later, we actually had a product that we can show to prospective investors. And I remember this because that same summer, I had a party for my last venture. I brought all the investors together really to celebrate the success of the last business. But I used that meeting to pitch my new idea to get them to reinvest the money that they've made from Zwift, from Circana Technology into Zwift. And they got like 7 or 8 times their money. And so a number of them actually wrote another check into the Zwift business. But we had something much more exciting, and it was a bigger story. And I think, you know, we had a great pitch deck with video to back it up. And I think people got super excited. And I think we had the credibility because we had done something successful. And it's just in a completely different space. We've been able to start from scratch, turn it into a successful business, give a return to the investors. So we're able to leverage that, you know, experience and credibility to then launch something new, which was much closer to my passion. It was a much bigger idea. And we were willing to put our own money, like significant amounts. I think my partner and I each put in $1 million into this business, you know, and not many entrepreneurs, if you're starting from scratch, can afford to do that. But we were in a very luxury position to be able to do that. So we had a lot of support from the investors. So I pitched to 200 friends and family, and 100 of them invested. So the original round was, let's go and raise $3 million, you know, from our friends and family. And we ended up raising, I think, $7 million from friends and family. So we were well oversubscribed. I also told my partners, and this is a funny story, I told my partners, hey, I'm going to set the price at $20 million pre-money valuation because I think it's a huge idea. I think they all thought I was on drugs. And so anyone who thought I was really crazy, I said, okay, you're not coming to the investor. And so, we managed to pull off the valuation. Again, why was that important? It helped protect dilution. And we sold, you know, maybe a third of the company for $7 million. And off we went. We had a great launch. And I remember even the launch event, which was 2014, we did it with Rafa and a number of big brands, Team Sky. We did it with Pinarello, Wahoo, and Elite, and others. I don't know what I was thinking, but we decided to have a launch party at the end of September in London, New York, and San Francisco, exactly at the same time with media in all 3 locations where they can all ride together. We pulled it off, but it was just like, what the hell were we thinking? Because, you know, a lot of things could have gone wrong. But we had one of the superpowers that we had was to be able to bring all the industry partners together, because in that respect, we're really a part, we're a platform. Right. We're a platform where brands like Pinarello and, you know, Team Sky and Rafa could all be, you know, activating on our platform. And so I think they were excited about what we're doing. They didn't quite understand what we were doing, but they still wanted to be part of it. And on the back of that, we got a lot of media press. You know, one of the smart things I think we did in the beginning was to hire a PR firm before launching this thing. And so there was a lot of noise and a lot of free PR, and people just didn't understand what we're doing, but we got a lot of press. Of course, that led to a closed beta that we were advertising. And I think we had like 30,000 people sign up for Zwift, which was...
That's a lot of people, especially at the very beginning. Wow.
Yeah. So we had, it was closed. So we had, from there, we started to say, okay, we only support Mac and PC. And then we worked our way down and opened it up because we needed the customers to give us feedback about the product. We literally launched with a small map called Jarvis Island, which was a small airfield. It's a small island in the South Pacific. It was an airfield that was last used during World War II. And we used it because it didn't conflict with any Strava segment. Like there were no Strava segments on that island until we arrived. And I remember when people started to ride on it and then post to Strava, because we had integration, you know, from day one. people ask me, like, I didn't know you were in the South Pacific. What are you doing in Jarvis? This is how people started to hear about Zwift, because it was coming through their Strava feed. Like, why are you South Pacific? Again, this is like the word of mouth, right? This is all kind of like...
So that was your growth hack at the beginning?
That was a bit of a growth hack, yeah. And the other thing that we, you know, looking back, we did, which was smart, was like we kept the map to 3 miles. It was 5K. And the reason is our thesis was like, look, you want whenever you show up on Jarvis, you want people to see each other. So when you don't have much population, if you have a big map and they don't see each other, it doesn't feel communal, right? It doesn't feel social. It's fun when you bump into someone with a flag from Denmark or from China or from, you know, from Australia. That's what makes it so interesting. These are people you would never meet in the real world, right? And they were doing that on Jarvis. We had very, very limited functionality. I remember when we launched, we only had this simple circuit. And the only thing on offer were 3 jerseys. One jersey was the King of the Mountain. There was a little hill, so you could get a KOM jersey. Another one was the green jersey, which is like the fastest sprint segment. And the third one was the orange jersey, which is like the fastest lap time. That's all we offer. And you can only hold it for 1 hour. And then after 1 hour, it gets reset to someone else. So it gave you the opportunity to go in there and chase something. So that was the only reward gamification that we had, was that we didn't have this concept of events. We didn't have concept of racing. We didn't have concept of training, nothing. It was just those 3 jerseys. And people showed up and loved chasing these things. So that was the beginning of Zwift. And then, of course, today, you know, it's 9 years later, it's progressed from there. But that was like the early days. Those are fun days, boy. I remember getting so excited when we saw 100 people riding together at the same time. We went to New York City and we celebrated. It was a big moment for us.
That's incredible. The first, I wanted to ask you a few questions on the things that you said. One, you mentioned that you had Rafa, you had Wahoo, you had so many of these great folks to be around. For a new entrepreneur, like, how do you get in front of these people? Was it that you knew them from before, or was it that the PR firm did the work to find them? And then I will ask the second question in a bit.
Yeah, so that's a very good question. I happened to be in the industry, like I understood all the big influencers. Of course, we had the PR firm who could help out wherever they could, but I also had friends in the industry. One of my friends, and he's still a very good friend of mine, is Joao Correa. He runs the Ngamba Tour, and he's also a rider agent. He became an advisor, and he opened up his network to me, introduced me to Pinarello. And then from there, we started to connect all the dots. And I made a lot of trips. Actually, my one of my co-founders and I, we flew everywhere, to Europe, to all over North America, and met as many people as we could to build all these relationships, knowing that having all these brands on our platform would give it that authenticity, you know, that we alone as a brand new brand couldn't do ourselves. I think that was another, like, looking back strategically, having all of these partnerships, like even if they were not formal, was really important, because it's influence. Influence is really important, as you know.
So that's from that side. So basically, I'm wondering, from those 30,000 people that you mentioned at the beginning that came from that big launch, how many stayed, and how much did the growth hack help through Strava? Did you do other things as well in the early days?
So I think many of those early adopters are still at, you know, at Zwift. It's incredible. Like, we, if you think about how many people have reached level 60, how many people have been around for a long time, it's those original cohorts are largely with us, I would say. These are, you know, very dedicated, committed Zwifters. In terms of the growth hack, the Strava one was super helpful, because that's where everyone's swimming, right? The downside of Strava is that, and, you know, of course, I had lunch with the co-founders earlier this week. The downside of the Strava feed is that you're only limited to your own network, right? If someone is only following, you know, 100 people, well, that my feed into that friendship is only 200 people. So it's limited, but it was still very impactful. And I think you know, we launched, you know, at the end of September. So right as we would go into the winter season. And this is when I think the explosion around like indoor cycling and indoor trainers, I think we really grew up together. Like, you know, if you take a company like Wahoo and Tax, these two companies in particular, they really, we really grew and we were, it was a very symbiotic relationship. Like we needed them just as much as they needed us. And so it was great timing because when we entered the space, the protocol for how software connects to the hardware was opening up and being standardized, making it easier for companies like ourselves and for hardware companies to connect to lots of different platforms. So I think we, you know, the timing was always, is always important. And I think we hit the right timing. There was clearly demand for it. The real question for many people is like, well, is this a real niche? Is this a niche business or is this really expansive and big? And does it go beyond like this, you know, cycling enthusiast market, like the competitive enthusiast market? And our thesis from the very beginning was like, first of all, the cycling market is pretty big by itself. And it's only going to get bigger over time because it's an activity that is so convenient to do from, of course, like Peloton was also kind of getting started just before us. And they were taking the spin market by storm. And then, of course, you know, COVID happened. So like both ups and downs for you know, many, many companies, many industries. Yep. But yeah, the hacking part was like, how do we leverage the brand partnerships where there's a mutual benefit? You know, how do you leverage companies like Strava, Garmin, Connect, and, you know, provide value, right? It's not just us taking value away, but like, how do we also give value to them?
How did the product evolve over the years? So, how did you also on based on also on that question, how did you this make these decisions for the product evolution?
Well, this is always a heated debate internally for us, even because there's no shortage of ideas. There's so many things that we can do. And over the years, early on, we try to do too much. And I think as we mature as a company, we try to take fewer and bigger bets and not try to do stuff that probably will have, you know, likely less impact. But I've been saying this and we've been saying this in turn, like, you know, over the years, like, how do we make it easier for people to get onboarded on Zwift, right? It's complicated, you know, especially early on when we weren't selling hardware. You'd have to go and do some research and shop for hardware and then show up on Zwift and subscribe. Like that whole purchasing experience, onboarding experience has never been very easy at Zwift. Right. And that to some extent has slowed down our growth. And this is why we have decided to, you know, to get into the hardware business, just to simplify things, make it more affordable, and then delight the customer, the first time customer, when they actually, you know, get on Zwift. So, you know, the features in the game, there are hundreds of features that we can do, but none of them are going to move the needle as much as like, how do we make it super easy to understand what Zwift is? How do we make it easy for them to buy in? How do we make sure that they have a great experience on their first ride on Zwift? And then it's the hundreds of features that we can offer them within, once you get into the game, to retain them, right? But it's the, you know, we have to work on all of those things, but it's not like any one game feature that's going to make a difference. I'd say if I step back, like what are the things that could really help grow our business? It's to empower our customers to create content themselves. Like, how do we allow them to make their own content on Zwift? And we have some tools through clubs where you can create a club, you can organize your own events, you can, you know, and some of them get their own custom kits. So we need to do more of that. Like we need to get out of the way of the customers and allow them to shape Zwift to be what they want it to be, you know, and become more of a platform that from that perspective. And the same thing for brands. Like there is like a long list of brands that want to work with us, and we just simply don't have the capacity and the resources to support all of them. So we really need to prioritize like these tools that they can then do self-service, and there's some model where they can come in and maybe it's a commercial model as well, where they can come in and really leverage the platform and then set up shop on Zwift. This is something, this is not a new strategy. This is a very old concept. It's just, you know, how do you execute that? So, yeah.
So what I'm hearing, you're investing a lot of basically how to reduce the time to value. And before our discussion, I was actually thinking about it too, which is if I want to start using Zwift today for the first time, it's pretty difficult because I need to have my bike, I need to have my setup, I need to get everything there. And it makes perfect sense that you're saying that you moved into the hardware business as well. Which new thing that you're building do you think is going to really help to improve this even more?
Well, there are just so many layers of friction that we need to combat. What we learn over time is that consumers are very, very lazy. They're lazy, and if you give them three clicks to do, like, they may not buy something, right? You've got to get rid of those clicks, as just an example. So, the reality is that we're not just an app. You need the kit. You need the hardware to have the experience. So, like it or not, even if we don't manufacture our own hardware, our customers need the hardware to get onto Zwift. So, you know, breaking down the barriers, simplifying, for example, we're the only ones in the market that allows consumers to pick the cassette that they want, right? The worst thing that can happen is you buy this trainer and then you realize, oh, it doesn't come with a cassette and doesn't work with my bike. Or it comes with a cassette and it comes with an 11 speed cassette, and you actually have a 7 speed cassette. And then what? You've got the tools to take it off? No. You're going to have to probably go to a bike shop, carry this 40-pound trainer, and then have someone take the new cassette and put a different cassette. Talk about friction. This is the kind of story that would probably turn many softer consumers away from even trying Zwift. So we have to just break down the barrier. Now, if you're a very serious, competitive, money is no object, like, that's not a problem for those. But that's not the mass market. Like, if in order for us to get the mass market, it's got to be affordable, it's got to be super simple. And, you know, it can't be a research project.
Mm. Would you say that the move in, for example, having a store that the user can experience it in person would help?
I think so. And, you know, all of our partners are selling trainers many of them are selling trainers at retail outlets and bike stores. So there are opportunities for consumers to go in and try it. But, you know, I bought a Tesla without even test driving it. I literally went out, I asked my friends, I watched some videos, and then I placed the order. Like, if people do that with cars, I think people would do that for smart trainers. You don't have to go. You just do a little bit of research and basically get some feedback from your friends. Your friends or the customers on Zwift are the biggest advocates to acquire new customers. It's not through advertising. It's people talking about your product. That is not for free, because you have to invest in brand and product, et cetera. But that is the most powerful acquisition tool you have, is the word of mouth and advocacy from your existing customers.
What did you do to enhance referrals over time?
Sorry, say that one more time.
What did you do to enhance the word of mouth and people speaking about it more often?
Yeah, I mean, it all comes down to the product experience, right? And every step of the way, from, learning about Zwift to onboarding to purchasing, to the first ride, to the second, third, 10th ride, we need to just continue to delight the customers along the entire journey. That is how you can ensure that flywheel that comes with the word of mouth. So you keep investing in the customer, keep investing in product. That's what, do, and we plan to do more of. Advertising can only go so far. The advertising has to match the experience, right? You can't over advertise, oversell, and then the experience doesn't meet expectations. So it's really important to just focus on the customer experience. I ride on Zwift almost every day, and I am the customer, right? I see the challenges, I see the opportunities, I also see the awesome experience that I get after 1 hour of Zwifting. It's amazing. Like, I feel awesome and it's super convenient. But it takes a while for you to get to that, you know, state. And anything we can do to just ease the, you know, the friction and the burden for the consumer is what we're really focused on.
One of the things that I've seen friends posting a lot is whenever they are riding and they are with a very famous athlete. So, for example, someone would post, I'm riding now and Lance is with me. Oh, I'm riding now. And I saw this very often. How did you get so many famous athletes to participate? Was it a deliberate effort or did they came because it was a great product?
I think a lot of it was authentic. You know, the pros really enjoy not riding in the rain and riding on Zwift. It all started with pros because of weather or because they're injured. And then they come on Zwift and then of course during the lockdown, right, of COVID, they all came, right? Because it's a very effective tool. Riding indoors, indoor training, it's proven that it's super effective and super efficient. It was just never fun, right? And even for pros, like they appreciate being around other people. They're social creatures like all of us. So yes, we give free accounts. If you're a pro, you confirm you're a professional, we give you a free account. You know, we're happy to do that. But that's not why they show up. They show up because they want to train. They want to be around other people. They're lonely. Training is very lonely experience for many professionals. I would say, you know, it's the casual rides that they do with other professionals or on Zwift. Some people live in parts like Andorra, where the only training you can do is go uphill. So if you want to do an easy ride in Andorra, you go on Zwift. it's been really interesting, and it's great to see both celebrities and professional cyclists. We also see plenty of like Formula One drivers and professional auto drivers and MotoGP athletes, athletes from other sports. It's pretty exciting because, yeah, who doesn't like to ride a bike?
Eric, when it comes to team building, I think building such a great company over time requires a lot of thoughtful hiring. What can we learn from your experience here? How are you hiring on Zwift, and how are you approaching it?
Yeah, so I can go back to the early days of hiring. You know, startups are really hard. And so you want to make sure you're surrounded by people you like, and they bring a certain skill set that you don't bring. Right. That's why, you know, co-founders, it should be obvious, like who's doing what. Right. But most importantly, you guys are, you know, you're aligned about what the, you know, the vision of the business and the excitement of what the business could be. Over time, obviously, you need to start bringing in people for different phases. So like the team that we needed for like up to Series A is one team. Like almost with every series, you need to have slightly different set of skills. And so I think that's, you know, there are people like if you want to hire, if you're in Series D, let's say, means it's pretty late stage. You want to bring in someone who has been at scale already, who might have already taken a company public. That's a very different person. You wouldn't hire that person pre-Series A. They wouldn't be the right person because it's just too small. They're probably not capable of operating in a small environment where you have to do the work, right? They're more like the managers. They're the ones who are more maybe strategic, and they bring in a team that they are comfortable working with, and they can focus on execution. So like for every phase of the growth of the business and the journey that you're on, just accept the fact that you need different team and mix it up, right? Some people can continue to grow and evolve across the different, you know, series. Others don't, and they want to go out and work on another company that's around the Series A, you know, stage. So, you know, I think that's the journey that we've been on at Zwift. Like, you know, we've had changes, and these changes are good in general. It's always tough to see people who you've worked with for many years go. But at the same time, I celebrate the contribution they've made to get us to where we are here. And they've been very, very successful, but like they're probably not the best place, you know, folks to take us through the next. And that is hard to kind of accept early on in your You know, if you're like a first-time entrepreneur, it's hard to accept that, but that is what happens often.
That's very interesting. What are the values that you would say that you are looking for when someone is going to join Zwift?
Yeah, well, the kind of folks that I love working with, I mean, you have to be passionate about what we do. Life is too short to do something, if you have the opportunity, to work on that's not, you know, a passion of yours. Like, so marrying passion with your professional skills, that's super important. I mean, it should always be more than just a job. So I look for someone who wants to go all in on this business because they believe in the mission, they believe in the business, they believe in, you know, how big this could be, right? You need someone who's willing to follow you through all the great times, but also the tough time to get there, right? And someone who is really committed. Commitment's first. And then, of course, they need to bring skills that you don't have. And I would say, always hire someone who you think is better than you. Not always easy for people to accept, but it's always better to hire someone who has better skills than you, who has more experience than you, who brings something that you don't have. It's scary for some entrepreneurs, but I embrace that because this is how you grow as a business. You know, you don't want to be the referee. You you want other people to keep raising the bar for the kind of talent and culture and execution that you need to be successful. It's hard. Look, startups are really hard.
Got it. I wanted to ask you. I was in an event. I think we spoke about it a bit earlier as well. But I was at the Super League Triathlon events, and I wanted to get your opinion about data and wearables. Because to give you some context, I was at the event. I was seeing all the very successful athletes being there. It was a triathlon event. A lot of people were in the crowd cheering up, and the athletes would basically cycle, and you would see the athletes through the screen. You would see their times, their power output, their speed, and all of that. And you could see it live in front of you. Plus, you could see it through Zwift. Yeah. And at the moment I walked there, I was like, this is the future of our space. It's unbelievable. I could not believe it. And I could see the heart rate of the athlete on the screen. I could see the speed of them. It was so, so phenomenal. I was shocked at that day. I wanted to see your opinion on that. One, it looks to me that the athletes' data are very, very close to... We can say that we can see athletes' data as content today. What are you thinking about this?
So first of all, I wasn't there for the event, but I heard the event was phenomenal. They sold out 2,000 tickets, you know? And they came to watch a brand new format. I mean, it's been going on for a couple of years now, but the arena games that the Super League Triathlon has created, where we are the platform for running and cycling. And, you know, triathlon is a very difficult sport to watch as a spectator, right? I mean, you can only really watch it on TV because they're just, you know, you do over 100 miles of, first of all, you do like 2 or 3 miles of swimming, and then you do like, you know, over 100 miles of cycling, and then you do a full marathon. That's not a very easy sport or, you know, event to watch live. So it's got to be on TV broadcast, but to be able to see all the athletes live in a swimming arena, a swimming pool, Olympic swimming pool, across all three disciplines, that's innovation, right? That is super exciting. You know, I think this is a sport that I think even the IOC are getting very excited about. Like, I could see this being an Olympic sport because it's manageable, right? Logistically manageable. You can bring in all the athletes. You can see them swimming and cycling and running all virtually with the fans there. And I think the broadcast is, I think it can get better over time. But then the richness of the data, right? To be able to see all that data. And maybe I think there's more we could do with the data for sure. We can just start thinking about made up data that could help us. Like, you know, for example, you know, the concept of like a fuel tank. Imagine like everyone has a fuel tank and we can gamify that. We're like, oh, this person has this much fuel tank left. And, you know, how are they optimizing their
moment
left? Right? Yeah, like, how cool would that be, right? If there was a, you know, it doesn't have to be super accurate, but like this concept, like, oh, that athlete is burning a lot more fuel than this other athlete. So it's still early days. I mean, right now we just have power you know, cadence, heart rate, speed, wattage, right? So I think there's more innovation there. And I think there's more innovation on how we can engage the spectator with this data and permutations of this data. But yeah, super excited with our partnership with Super League Triathlon. And they have big ambitions. And I do see that being an Olympic sport. I really do, because it checks a lot of the boxes.
Would you say that the way that the athletes are participating in the event is going to change? Because looking at someone's, like, if you are looking at the person in front of you running faster than you, but you also see that their exact speed, then you could look at the screen as well, increase your speed, and make it easier for you to get there. Would this change their behavior, do you think?
I don't know how they're managing their competition. Certainly they're seeing the position, you know, virtually, and, you know, they can see the performance of the other athletes when they're running or cycling. They can see if how fast they're going or how, you know, what the time gaps are. There's a lot more information for these athletes in the arena games than there are in the real world, because they just don't get those time splits, right? So they're operating with way more information in these games. And that's why I think competition is, well, first of all, they're much shorter distance, and the time gaps are much smaller, which also makes it for a more interesting competition.
If we actually see the data of the athletes as well in the prior days, so for example, you see their training, you see their HRV, you see their sleep, you see all that information, I think there is going to be a lot of optimization, and that is going to change this field for good. But in the terms that you mentioned, that in the Olympic Games that you see is becoming an Olympic game as well, I was literally thinking about it when I was there. Like, is there other events that you think that Zwift can do, like maybe running, for example, or something similar?
Running possibly, but I think the ones that have the most leg is the Super League Triathlon, but also cycling esports, which we've hosted 3 years now, the World Championships. So I think these two disciplines, of course, they're separate sports. One's triathlon, the other one's cycling. But these two have real legs for an Olympic berth. The London game was an official World Championships for the arena games. It had that prestige. And the governing body for triathlon has sanctioned it as the World Championships for the arena. So already we've got the World Championship, official World Championships, so the arena games and the cycling esports. So yeah, you know, we've got the Paris Olympics coming up. It's obviously too early for that, but I think this is when they start having conversations about, like, you know, what new sports should go into the 2028 Olympic, which happens to be in LA in our backyard. So it's been a 10-year. It's like a 10-year journey for us, but like we've had this vision for many years now. Like, we're going to make it into the Olympics. We're going to help create new discipline, new events for the Olympics that marries, you know, digital with, you know, with real athletes, right? It's a real athletic endeavor. It's not just like traditional gaming. And I think the IOC sees these two disciplines in particular that checks the box of, okay, these are real athletes, real physical efforts, but there's somehow, like, gaming is involved, right? Like they can get that. I think it's harder for them to consider like a shooting game as an Olympic sport, for example, you know, a video game. So yes. I feel pretty good about, you know, where the sports are headed, and to the extent that Zwift can play a role in creating these digital or hybrid kind of sporting disciplines.
As a last question, where would you say that, what should we expect from Zwift next year, by next year, and then within the next 5 years?
Well, you know, these are challenging times, right? Just market-wise, but our focus is to continue to optimize the customer experience. There's so much for us to do. And I'm super excited about our strategy around doing more for the customer, the experience once you're in the game. There's a ton of gamification that we can add, tools that we can offer to each user to create their own content. I think I'm super excited about mobilizing our customers to help find, build communities, you know, that they want. Just empower them. And so, you know, if there is, of course, it, you know, I can't end this podcast without mentioning the, you know, the metaverse, but, you know, we have been living the metaverse since we started, right? Every day or, you know, daily, people take an hour of their time and go into the metaverse called Zwift. And they, this is how they spend an hour of fitness in this virtual world. And they have an identity there, they have friends there. And then they, you know, when they're done, they come out into the real world and then do other things. And I think that is just a slice of like what the metaverse will be like going forward, where people dip in and out for different experiences. One could be like around, oh, I'm going to do gaming. Or another one could be, oh, this is where I go and learn something. Or here I go and do some work. Like Zoom, you could say, is like, is that already? So people already see that as a real thing. And we certainly are embracing the concept of virtual worlds and the metaverse. And I think Zwift is well positioned to be the category leader. I think by default we are. But, you know, how do we turn this into a much bigger universe? You know, how do we get more people who are non-cyclists, who are not cyclists today or runners today, and get them to, you know, join this community to inspire them, to motivate them, to want to train and become part of a new sport?
Excellent. Eric, thank you so much.